Me neither. He switched his light back on. Should I get us some milk or something? Tea? No, thanks, yawned Ellen. She sat up. He said without any real enthusiasm. Should we have sex, do you think? Ellen laughed. I'm not feeling especially amorous. No, agreed Patrick. He sat up. I think I'll go write an abusive email to that client, or punch something, or run around the block. Let me do you a relaxation, said Ellen. She would be glad of the distraction. You've got enough on your mind, said Patrick. It's fine, said Ellen. I go into a trance too. Oh God, thank you. I didn't want to ask. Patrick lay down next to her. I can't believe how hooked I've got on this. 10 minutes later, he was in a medium trance, and Ellen herself was in that lovely liquid state she seemed to reach whenever she hypnotized Patrick. I want you to go back to a time when you felt completely relaxed. A time long before the stresses of running your own business. Think of a time when you felt completely relaxed and happy. Are you there yet? He nodded. Where are you? Honeymoon, said Patrick. His voice had that stupid drugged quality. Ellen went very still. Stop right there, said Flynn's voice in her head. She paused, considering, listening to Patrick's deep, even breaths. Ask him, said Danny. Ask him what you want to know. What are you doing? She said to Patrick. There was nothing wrong with that. In the soft lamplight, Patrick looked 10 years younger. The lines between his eyes had smoothed out and his cheeks looked plumper. We're snorkeling, he said. You and Colleen, checked Ellen. Who else? Julia snorted in her head. Oh, what a load of rubbish, said her mother. He's just describing a memory to you. This isn't time travel. Yes, it's stunning, Patrick smiled. Col is wearing a blue bikini. Is she? Said Ellen faintly. She looks gorgeous. Great, said Ellen. Julia was rolling about laughing in her head. You asked for it, you idiot. Highly unprofessional, said Flynn. Describe what you're feeling, said Ellen, trying to get him back on track. I've never been snorkeling before. Everything feels slow down and still, and all I can hear is my breathing. The coral is... Oh, but I have to tell her. His face changed. The lines reappeared, dragging down his cheeks. Tell her what? Said Ellen. Sometimes a simple relaxation exercise could bring up repressed negative feelings. It had never happened before with Patrick. It wasn't meant to happen with Patrick. This wasn't a proper session. This was just helping him forget about the horrible client so he could go to sleep. And this is exactly why we don't recommend hypnotizing your partner, said Flynn. To see the doctor. Now. Right now. We have to go and see a doctor and catch it. The cancer, before it's too late. Patrick's hand opened and closed reflexively around the bedsheet. She's so stupid. So stubborn. She felt that lump and she never said a word, for months, just hoping it was nothing, hoping it would go away. Just like she hoped the oil light would stop flashing in her car. Jesus Christ, you idiot, I said to her. You idiot. I made her cry. I shouldn't have made her cry. But she had a responsibility. To Jack. To me. Grief ravaged his face. It's time to let this memory slip away, said Ellen. Her voice did not have the appropriate level of authority. She sounded like a beginner, shaky and forced. I will never love another woman like her. On the count of five, said Ellen. I look at Ellen, said Patrick. Ellen froze. And I think, it's not the same. It's just not the same. After they walked in to have their ultrasound, I couldn't stop crying. I had to leave. I was making a spectacle of myself. A woman came out from behind the reception desk and started walking toward me with a kind, purposeful expression on her face that meant, I sympathize, but please shut the hell up. I guess people aren't always crying tears of joy here. Ultrasounds don't always mean good news. The woman probably thought I'd lost a baby. What could I have said to her? No, I've never actually been pregnant, but I did lose my stepson. Does that count? He's that beautiful kid over there helping his new stepmother with her handbag. He looks tired. I don't think she's feeding him right. Too much tofu and lentils. Not enough protein. And although I didn't lose an actual baby, I did lose a dream baby. Because that man over there stopped loving me. And now I'm too old and he's found someone younger and nicer. They would say, no, that certainly does not count. Stop embarrassing yourself. Show some dignity, some self-respect. Fair enough, too. As I went down in the lift, I was still crying but wasn't really aware of feeling any particular emotion. The tears were like a symptom of some peculiar disease. I was just waiting for them to stop. I was walking back to my car when the pain in my leg suddenly became unbearable. If I used Ellen's dial metaphor, it was like someone had twisted it up to high. It was impossible to walk. I had to sit down. I looked around for a bus stop or a wall, but there wasn't one anywhere, so I just sat down in the gutter like a drunk. I couldn't believe that just half an hour earlier I was dealing so efficiently with those developers, and now here I was, crying in a gutter. A man who had parked his car just in front of where I sat down came over to ask if I was okay. He looked like he was in his late 60s, one of those weathered friendly faces like a man from the outback. He reminded me of Patrick's dad. He seemed convinced that he'd seen me twist my ankle and was talking about getting ice for it and how I needed to keep it elevated, and it took quite a while for him to realize that my ankle was fine. I finally had to explain to him that I had a pain in my leg that could not be explained or cured, and that I wasn't crying because of the pain, but because of something personal. He pulled his wallet out of his pocket and took out a card. For a moment I thought he was giving me the name of a therapist, but he said, "This guy's a brilliant physio. I had terrible back pain a few months ago, excruciating, nearly brought me to tears. He fixed me right up, good as new." I thanked him and didn't bother telling him that I'd already been to 7 different physiotherapists and I wasn't going to waste any more of my money. "In the meantime, take a really strong painkiller," he said, "and forget that schmuck, his loss, right? Plenty more fish in the sea for a gorgeous girl like you." He gave me a little pat on the shoulder, and then he suddenly seemed embarrassed, as if he was worried he might be acting inappropriately. He stood up quickly and his knees made a loud cracking sound, which his brilliant physio might need to take a look at. Nice people. How do they get so nice? And how do they sustain it? All that smiling and caring and sharing. It must be exhausting and so time-consuming, keeping an eye out for strangers in need. As I watched him go, I thought, for the first time in years, it must be nice to have a dad. I bet Ellen has a lovely father, a daddy who bounced her on his knee and called her his princess. She has the look of someone who has been adored by her father. I called up the office from the gutter and told them that I was going to work from home for the rest of the day. I managed to hobble back to the car, and when I got home, I took the nice, dad-like man's advice and found an old prescription painkiller in my medicine cupboard. I took 2, and then I fell asleep. When I woke up, the brother and sister from the nice family next door were home from school, and they were in the backyard. I tried to do some work, but my head felt so fuzzy and peculiar, and I kept getting distracted by the sounds of their playing. For nice children, they didn't seem to be playing so nicely. It sounded like a toxic relationship, one minute laughter and singing, and the next tears and screams of, "Stop it!" I was under the impression that children stayed indoors these days and played computer games. Eventually, I gave up trying to work, and I opened a bottle of red wine. I thought I would toast Patrick's new baby. That was my mistake. I've never been much of a drinker. Ellen dreamed. Her dreams were vivid and endless and exhausting. She knew she was dreaming, and she kept trying to wake up properly so the dreams would stop, and every now and then she would find herself back in the reality of the dark room, turning over to readjust her pillow, nudging Patrick to stop him snoring. But then before she could stop herself, she'd find herself falling asleep again, toppling headfirst into a canyon of swirling thoughts and faces and sounds. Her mother and her godmothers were running along a beach, naked, laughing in that schoolgirl way that always made her feel left out. "They're showing off," she said to her father, who was sitting on the beach next to her, fully dressed, thankfully, in his suit and tie. He had sauce from his Moroccan chicken wrap on his lip. Ellen said, "The daughter's relationship with her father is a model for all her future relationships. She felt proud, as if she was making some sort of incredibly subtle, ironic, witty point. Her father was reading the newspaper now. He glanced up at her with an expression of pure disgust on his face.
"This article is about you," he said.
"It's not true," said Ellen, filled with shame and hurt beyond belief.
"It is true,"
said a girl who was sitting in front of Ellen, patting a sandcastle into shape with a yellow spade.
"Colleen,"
said Ellen. She was going to be extremely nice to her because that's the sort of person she was.
"How are you?"
She tried to think of a topic of conversation that would interest Colleen. "I hear that you sewed your own wedding dress," she said. "You must be so talented."
"You're being condescending," said Julia. She was sunbaking on her stomach and lifted her head from her towel to speak.
"She should never have got pregnant," said Colleen to Julia. "That was unethical of her."
"Probably," yawned Julia, "but she means well."
"It was unethical because he's still in love with me," said Colleen complacently.
"But you're dead," cried Ellen, suddenly remembering and filled with the injustice of her accusation.
"You're a very pretty girl," said Ellen's father to Colleen. Colleen tilted her head.
"Thank you, David."
"Well, I'm so sorry for getting pregnant," said Ellen. She knew she was acting petulantly because she was jealous of her father complimenting Colleen, but she couldn't seem to stop herself. She began to fling handfuls of sand at her own face.
"How can I redeem myself? What can I do to make it up to you?"
"Ellen, stop it. You are making an absolute fool of yourself," said Madeline, who was sitting on the old couch they had when they shared a flat.
"Did you hear something?"
said Patrick. Ellen woke to see Patrick sitting up next to her in bed, rubbing his eyes.
"It's just the wind, I think," said Ellen.
Outside, the wind was howling, making the windows rattle. She sat up and reached for the glass of water on the bedside table.
"Sorry," said Patrick. He lay back down.
Ellen tipped back her water glass. It was empty. She didn't remember drinking it. She looked at the clock. Only 4 a.m. This night would never end.
"I'm having all these peculiar dreams," said Ellen. There was a bang as a branch or something landed on the roof.
"Me too," said Patrick. "It's the wind."
"You said something when I was doing your relaxation," said Ellen.
"Hmm?"
said Patrick.
"About Colleen."
She waited. Patrick snored.
Ellen lay back down and instantly dreamed again. This time she was walking down the aisle on her wedding day, wearing her grandmother's dress. She was carrying the baby in the palm of her outstretched hand. The baby was the size of a bead, and it was rolling back and forth across her palm.
"Keep your hand flat, you'll drop it,"
said one of the wedding guests. Ellen turned her head to see that it was her client, Louisa, wearing a big hat.
"You don't even know how to look after a baby. I should be the pregnant one. Give it to me."
"I gave you your money back," said Ellen briskly. "There's nothing more I can do. I am a good person."
She kept walking. She could see Patrick at the end of the aisle, facing away from her. He turned around to look at her, and Ellen smiled at him, but his face changed.
"Stop following me," he yelled. His voice echoed throughout the whole church. "It's over. Can't you understand? I never loved you."
Ellen was mortified.
"Patrick, it's not Saskia. It's me,"
she called out. She tried to keep her voice light and cheery because it was a wedding after all, but loud enough for Patrick to hear right down the other end of the aisle, which had become as long as an airport runway.
"Leave me alone," shouted Patrick.
"Darling, I don't think he loves you anymore,"
said her mother. She and the godmothers were dressed up like bridesmaids from the 80s, in pink taffeta dresses with giant puffed sleeves.
"Men," said Pip. "Who needs them? Let's get drunk."
"You'll meet someone else," said Mel.
"I never really liked him much anyway," sniffed Ellen's mother.
"He thinks I'm Saskia," said Ellen. "I'm sure it's just a mix-up."
But actually, she wasn't sure. Had she been the one stalking Patrick all along?
"You hypnotized me into moving those boxes," shouted Patrick. "You manipulated me."
"I'm sorry," cried Ellen.
He was breaking up with her. This relationship was going to end just like all her other relationships. She was going to have to bring this baby up on her own, and it was so teeny tiny. She closed her hand carefully around the baby bead and began to run, but as soon as she did, her legs lurched sickeningly as if she'd run off a cliff. She opened her eyes. She couldn't tell if it was morning or night. The bedroom seemed to be filled with a strange, eerie, orange-yellow light. It was like there had been a fire, except there was no smell of smoke. She could hear Patrick's rattly breathing that was not quite snoring, and the hollow, rhythmic sound of waves crashing on the beach. And she could hear or sense something else. Something not right. There was a long, dark shape at the end of the bed. Ellen stared, her heart hammering, waiting for her eyes to adjust and for the shape to become a familiar object, like a chair or a dressing gown hanging on a door. It moved. Ellen's lungs filled with air. A woman was standing in their bedroom, at the foot of their bed, watching them sleep. Ellen scrabbled back so fast that her head banged painfully against the headboard. Colleen. Colleen back from the dead to claim her husband.
"What is it?" said Patrick sleepily.
He sat up and rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands. Then suddenly he flung back the covers and crawled straight across the bed.
"Get out!" he roared. "Get out!"
It wasn't Colleen. It was Saskia. She was wearing pajama pants with a football jersey over the top. Her hair was wet and plastered to her head. Her feet were bare.
"Patrick," she said. She stepped back to avoid his grasp. "I just wanted..."
Patrick fell out of the bed and onto the floor in an ungainly sprawl. Ellen saw that Saskia was holding something in her hand. It was the ultrasound pictures that they'd left on the kitchen table.
"Hey!"
She'd never heard her voice sound like that before, as if it had been scraped raw.
"Give those back!"
She got out of bed and moved towards Saskia.
"They're mine!"
There was a terrified shriek from the hallway.
"Daddy!"
"Jack," said Saskia. She half turned toward the door. Patrick got to his feet and grabbed Saskia by both arms. He lifted her up into the air as if he was going to slam her against the wall. The ultrasound photos fell from her hand onto the floor. Ellen saw that Patrick was trembling all over, his eyes wild and crazed. "He's going to kill her," she thought. "It's my job to stop him killing her." She grabbed for the back of Patrick's t-shirt.
"I just want to explain."
Saskia tried to drape her arms around Patrick's neck. He shoved her away and she fell to her knees.
"Dad!"
screamed Jack.
"Ellen, what's happening?"
"Get out!"
Patrick dragged Saskia to her feet.
"Get out now!"
"I'm sorry,"
sobbed Saskia. She fell against Patrick's chest again, and with Ellen still clutching the back of his t-shirt, they shuffled out into the hallway in a strangely intimate dance. Dawn was breaking, and through the open door of her office, opposite their bedroom, where Ellen would normally see the beach and the ocean, all she could see was a haze of apocalyptic orange. Yellow light poured into the house. She let go of Patrick's t-shirt and stared. What was going on? Was it war?
"Daddy, it's Armageddon!"
Ellen turned her eyes back in time to see Patrick shove Saskia away from him, just as Jack came pounding down the hallway in his pajamas, his eyes gigantic with fear. Saskia slipped on the hallway runner and she flung out an arm to save herself. Her flailing hand clutched at Jack's pajama top and the two of them fell together, toppling, crashing, rolling. Chapter 22.
"Careful!"
Mothers throughout the world, throughout time. For one long, endless, silent moment, Ellen and Patrick stood at the top of the staircase, their hands gripped on the landing banister, their eyes fixed on Jack and Saskia below. Saskia was on her back. One leg was bent at a sickeningly strange angle. Her head lolled. Her face was obscured by her hair. Jack was flat on his stomach, his legs straight, his palms down on the floor as if he was asleep in bed.
"They're both dead," thought Ellen with certainty, and she was seized by the terrifying revelation that this actually happened.
Exactly like this, all the time, every day. People died. Children died. In clumsy, stupid accidents that took only a few seconds, and afterward you kept breathing and your heart kept pumping and everything was still exactly the same. The unacceptable happened and you were expected to accept it. Patrick made a sound like a dog's whimper. Then Jack moved and Patrick reacted instantly. He went clattering down the stairs so fast that as Ellen ran behind him, she called out, "Careful!" Jack sat up on his haunches, cradling his arm. His face was dead white. "I think I broke it," he said in a matter-of-fact tone, and then he turned his head and was sick all over the floor. Ellen and Patrick fell to their knees on either side of him. "Oh, darling," said Ellen. She lifted the sleeve of his pajamas and saw that his arm was already starting to swell and looked oddly deformed. "You're okay, mate," said Patrick unconvincingly. He looked like he might faint. Jack lifted his head and wiped his hand across his mouth. He stared at them with streaming, baffled eyes.
"What's happened? I don't understand. Why is Saskia here?"
"Don't worry about that," said Patrick. He went to reach for Jack as if to pick him up. "I'm going to take you to emergency."
"No, you mustn't move him," said Ellen. "He might have a back or head injury. Just lie him down and keep that arm still. I'll call an ambulance. Let me just check on Saskia."
"Forget Saskia," hissed Patrick.
"Why is she here?" said Jack again.
His eyes widened as he saw her over Ellen's shoulder.
"Is she all right?"
"Just forget about her," said Patrick.
"No!"
yelled Jack. His voice was unexpectedly loud in the silent house. Patrick blanched.
"It's all right, mate."
Jack pulled away from him.
"You can't just forget about her. Stop saying that. Just because you don't like her, it's not fair."
"Everything is okay," said Patrick soothingly.
"Check on her."
Jack's face went from white to bright red. His small chest heaved beneath his pajama top and his eyes glittered with fury. Ellen stared. She had never seen a small child experiencing such grown-up emotions. She said, "I'll make sure she's okay, Jack." There are some parts that I know I'll never forget, and some parts that I expect I'll never remember. Like, I don't remember calling a taxi, but I do remember pulling up in front of Ellen's house and paying the driver. I gave him a $10 tip, and we talked about the wind. It was howling. I remember the trees swaying back and forth like women lamenting their dead children. I felt exhilarated and wild, a woman in the forest embracing my inner something or other. I remember touching my hair and realizing it was dripping wet and being confused because it wasn't raining. I must have stepped straight out of the shower and called a cab. At least I didn't drive when I was drunk. Some rational part of my mind knew enough to call a cab. I don't remember why I decided to go to Ellen's house, but I can guess my train of thought. I was probably standing in the shower and imagining Ellen and Patrick getting ready to go to bed at the same time, and how they would have been talking about their day, about how exciting it was to see the baby for the first time, and I would have thought, I wish I could see them. And at that point I must have thought, why not go there right now? Or maybe I felt an overwhelming desire to tell Patrick something, that I loved him or I hated him, that I understood or I would never understand, that I was letting him go, finally, this was it, I would never go near him again, or that I would never let him go or I would love him for the rest of my life. Who knows? The next thing I remember is standing at the foot of their bed. Patrick was flat on his back, his mouth open, snoring in that way of his, where each snore goes further up in the scale in volume until there's an enormous shuddery one that half wakes him and he stops, and then a few seconds later it starts again. Ellen was lying on her side, with her hands folded in prayer under her cheek, just like you'd expect her to sleep, although she was snoring too in a gentler, more regular rhythm than Patrick. Their snoring sounded comical, as if they were trying to play a tune together and kept getting it wrong and having to start again. I didn't feel envy or anger or pain. I felt calm and quite friendly toward them. I think it was because of the snoring. So I got a shock when they woke up and I saw their reactions, the fear on their faces. I wanted to say, "No, no, relax, it's only me." It was like Patrick had seen some sort of dangerous animal, as if I were a grizzly bear looming over him. Me, just me, Saskia. I don't even kill cockroaches. He knows that. And then Ellen was yelling at me about something in my hand, and I looked down and saw that I was holding their baby's ultrasound pictures, although I didn't remember picking them up or looking at them.
She reacted as if I was stealing her baby. Technically, she stole my baby. I could have got pregnant with Patrick's baby if we'd kept trying. I might have. They woke Jack up with all their noise. I heard him call out. So then I just wanted everyone to calm down. I wanted them to know that there was no need for anyone to be upset. It was like a nightmare where you suddenly realize you're naked in a shopping center. A tiny voice in my head said, Saskia, you've gone too far. What would Mum think? Mum would not approve of me upsetting Jack. Nobody would calm down. Patrick refused to listen. He was pushing me, shoving me. I noticed that everything had turned sepia as if we were in an old photograph. It added to that nightmarish, surreal feeling. I remember Jack running down the hallway in his pajamas, his eyes and mouth huge with terror. That voice in my head saying, This is your fault, Saskia. And then somehow we were falling together, and I was trying to hold on to him, to stop him from hurting himself. It was terrible. That was the last thing I remember before I woke up in the hospital and felt the most unbearable pain shatter the lower half of my body, as if someone was dropping bricks on me from a great height. And I saw Ellen standing with her back to me at the hospital window. I must have made some sort of noise because she turned around and smiled at me. She didn't look frightened. She smiled at me as if I was a normal person, not a grizzly bear. She said, There's been a big dust storm. It was the first thing that came into her head. Sydney is covered in dust, she said. It really looks quite apocalyptic out there. No wonder Jack thought it was the end of the world. I actually thought there had been a nuclear blast myself. Saskia stared up at her blankly, as if she was speaking a foreign language. They can see it from space, apparently, said Ellen. She took a deep breath and sat down on the chair next to Saskia's bed. That's why it took a while for the ambulance to come this morning. The city is in chaos. Saskia's eyes moved slowly down the bed and the white hospital blanket covering her body. You fractured your pelvis, said Ellen, and your right ankle. You might need surgery for the ankle, but they think the pelvis should heal itself. You can press the little button here for more pain relief. There was silence. Ellen's eyes locked with Saskia's. It felt shocking as if the strange connection between the two of them was more intimate than that of two sexual partners. I don't know if you remember what happened, began Ellen. Jack, said Saskia clearly. He's broken his arm, said Ellen, but other than that, he's fine. Saskia's face crumbled.
My fault.
Well, said Ellen. Yes. Jack went through a stage when he was a toddler when he seemed to be constantly hurting himself. He'd bang his head on the coffee table, his elbow against the doorframe. As soon as one bruise or graze healed, he'd get another one. I'd be down the other end of the house and hear the crash, the pause, and then the anguished scream that shredded my heart. I'd think, not again. Once Patrick was playing with him when it was past his bedtime and I was saying, Okay, that's enough now, because I knew Jack was getting overtired and he'd hurt himself soon. And sure enough, next thing Jack's yelling and spitting out blood because he'd banged his chin and bitten his tongue, and I was furious with Patrick. I must have said it 1,000 times. Careful! And now because of me, Jack had a broken arm. There was no denying my responsibility. There was no way I could twist the events of the previous evening around to make it someone else's fault. Ellen sat there, just looking at me steadily. She looked exhausted, gray shadows under her eyes, pale lips, no makeup, messy hair, her face plain, ordinary even. Except that there was something so pristine about her. Looking at her was like looking at something natural and true. I caused Jack to break his arm. It was like someone was holding a screen right up close to my face, and it was playing a movie of everything I'd done for the last 3 years. Every text message, every phone call, every letter I knew he'd never read, leading up to the final sepia-colored moment when Jack and I crashed down the stairs. I closed my eyes to try and escape from it, but I could still see it. It was unflinching and unrelenting. I was being suffocated by shame.
Breathe, said Ellen. Just concentrate on your breathing. Inhale and exhale. Inhale and exhale. The sound of her voice was like an old familiar tune. It took me straight back to her little glass room overlooking the ocean. I listened greedily, as if her voice were oxygen. That's it. In and out. I opened my eyes and saw that she'd leaned in closer, so that her face was only inches from mine. She took my hand. Her hands were cold. My mother always had cold hands. Cold hands, warm heart, she used to say. Have you heard the phrase, hitting rock bottom? She said. She didn't wait for an answer. I noticed her voice had changed subtly. She was speaking in her professional voice. It's something that happens to addicts when they finally break down in every way possible. Physically, spiritually, emotionally. I think that's sort of what's happening to you right now, Saskia. And I don't know, but I think it probably feels terrible. I think it probably feels like the end of the world. I felt a wild flapping sensation in my chest, like a trapped bird. Ellen kept talking. But it's good. It's a good thing. It's even a great thing, because it's the turning point. It's the beginning of getting better. It's the beginning of getting your life back. I think you've probably tried to stop before, haven't you? Again, she didn't wait for me to reply. But this time, it's going to work. For one thing, you're going to be stuck. Ellen's eyes sparkled, as if it was all a great joke. They tell me you won't be walking for 6 to 8 weeks, and after that, you'll be on crutches. I didn't react to that at all. My future didn't seem possible. It had no relevance. And during that time, you'll get counseling, continued Ellen confidently, happily, as if we were discussing shared holiday plans that were already in place. It will be a good way to pass the time. And then, once you're back on your feet, I think you should move. She smiled. That might seem a bit presumptuous of me, but, well, I've got the right to be presumptuous. I think you need to move somewhere far away from Sydney, so you won't be tempted. Her hand tightened around mine. I expect Patrick will finally take out a restraining order against you, so legally you won't be able to come near us. He's going to need to do that, but what I need is a promise from you, a promise right now, that this is it, that last night was the end, and today is the beginning. The end of your old life and the beginning of your new life. Can you promise me that? I felt my head jerk up and down as if I were a puppet and she was pulling the strings. I said, I promise. She patted my hand and said, good. I became aware of the pain again. It gripped and viciously squeezed the lower half of my body, and it felt personal, as if someone was doing it on purpose. I tried not to resist it, to accept it as my punishment, but frankly it hurt too much. Give yourself a hit, said Ellen. She put something like a light switch in my hand. I pressed the button. A few seconds later I felt a sensation of fuzzy warmth, like pins and needles creeping up my legs, and the pain receded. I said, why are you here? Why are you being nice to me? My mouth felt as if it was full of marbles, as if I hadn't spoken for a very long time. Ellen went to speak, and then she stopped, as if she was reconsidering. She said, I don't really know. You frightened me, but at the same time you intrigued me. I even found it strangely validating. You watching us made my life seem more interesting. She shook her head. I was sort of addicted to you. You should hate me, I said. My voice sounded unfamiliar, slurred like a stroke victim. Patrick hates me. That's because I don't have the emotional connection that Patrick has to you. Patrick hates you because he once loved you. That's nice of you to say that, I said. My nose was running. I went to wipe it with the back of my hand and saw I had the drip attached. I sniffed noisily. I didn't even care. I had no dignity left to lose. I'm not that nice, said Ellen. When I saw you holding the ultrasound photos, I wanted to kill you. It turns out that I do have limits. I don't want you near my baby. Her eyes had turned steely. The words, "I'm sorry," came into my mind, but they seemed insultingly inadequate. I said instead, "Patrick is lucky to have you." And it occurred to me that I might actually mean it, that in a far-off, more generous part of my mind, I could even be happy for him. Her face shifted in some tiny, subtle way. She said, "He's still in love with his first wife." "Yes, of course," I said. I could feel my senses starting to drift. "He still loves Colleen. First love and all that, but so what? She's dead, isn't she? I always knew that I loved him more than he loved me, but I didn't care. I just loved him so much." A great wave of tiredness was dragging me somewhere far away. "I know you did." Ellen stood up, adjusting my blankets like a mother. "You loved him, and you loved Jack." For a moment I seemed to swim back up to lucidity again, and I said, "Have you hypnotized me?" She smiled. "I've been trying to unhypnotize you, Saskia." And then I was drifting away again, and I heard her say, "It's time to move on now, Saskia, and let go of all those memories of Patrick and Jack. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, or that Patrick didn't love you, or that you weren't a wonderful mother to Jack. I know that you were. It doesn't mean that he didn't hurt you terribly. But now it's time to close that door. Imagine an actual door. A big, heavy wooden door with an old-fashioned gold lock. Now close it. Bang. Lock it. Throw away the key. It's closed, Saskia. Closed forever." When I woke up again, the room was empty, and the hypnotist's visit seemed like a dream. Chapter 23. "Love? Give me chocolate any day." Ellen's godmother, Pip. "The suffragettes didn't starve themselves for the vote so that you girls could starve yourselves for a man." Ellen's godmother, Mel. "Oh, Lord, what superficial nonsense she'd been spouting. Close the door, close it forever. For heaven's sake, the woman had broken into their house in the middle of the night and watched them sleep. She was probably schizophrenic or bipolar or who knew what. She probably needed antipsychotic medication combined with intensive ongoing therapy. Ellen's sappy little comments were like giving her vitamins when she needed surgery. Also, closing the door wasn't quite the right metaphor. You didn't close the door on your memories. That was encouraging repression. Something to do with water might have been better. Cleanse yourself. Oh, whatever." Ellen yawned hugely without bothering to put her hand over her mouth. She was driving back from the hospital. There wasn't as much traffic as usual on the roads. People were staying home because of the dust storm. It was still windy, although not as bad as the previous night. The sky was heavy with gloomy clouds, and the entire city was covered in a fine layer of orange dust. Everything looked grimy. She drove by an empty outdoor cafe and saw a woman wearing a hospital mask and mopping the floor. A mother hurried from her car, carrying a toddler with a sheet draped over its head, like one of Michael Jackson's children. Then a young man wearing shorts and a t-shirt jogged by as if he'd jogged straight through from another day, a sunny, blue-skied, clean and ordinary day. "Why were you even talking to her? That's what everyone would say. You must be crazier than her. Did you take her chocolates and flowers, a get-well card?" She looked at her watch. It was noon. She thought back to early that morning. It seemed like days had passed since then, not hours. When it became obvious that Jack was well enough to move around, Patrick had decided to drive him to the hospital. It was clear to Ellen that he couldn't bear to sit and wait for an ambulance. He needed to be moving, taking action, and most important of all, he needed to be far away from Saskia. Ellen could sense the heat of his simmering fury emanating from his body like a low-grade fever. She offered to stay at home and wait for Saskia's ambulance. "You can't stay with her," Patrick had said. But Ellen pointed out that she was barely conscious, breathing shallowly and obviously in a great deal of pain. She wasn't a danger to anyone. And besides, they could hardly just leave her there alone with a note pinned to the door for the paramedics. Patrick hadn't been in the mood for light-hearted remarks of that nature. Let's call the police, he'd said, and hand her over. But Ellen had convinced him to concentrate on Jack. When the ambulance arrived, the paramedics told Ellen they were taking Saskia to Monavale Hospital, and not to try to follow them, but to take her time driving there, and that Saskia was in good hands. They seemed to take it for granted that Ellen would also be coming. So she got dressed and drove to the hospital and then sat for hours in a crowded waiting room, reading trashy magazines without absorbing a single word, surrounded by wheezing asthmatics who had been affected by the dust storm. Finally, a nurse told her that she could see Saskia for a few minutes. In the meantime, she'd spoken to Patrick once on his mobile. He'd taken Jack to a private hospital in Manly and they were waiting for an X-ray on his arm. He hadn't even asked about Saskia, and he obviously assumed that Ellen was still at home because he told her to try to get some sleep. How would he react when he heard she'd actually been at the hospital and that she'd talked to Saskia? Would he see it as a betrayal? Was it a betrayal? The thing was, talking to Saskia hadn't just felt like the right thing to do, it somehow felt imperative for both of them. Ellen thought about the despair on Saskia's face as she lay in that narrow hospital bed. She seemed to Ellen like someone who had lost everything in a natural disaster, someone who was trying to grapple with the fact that the entire framework of her life no longer existed. Had she really hit rock bottom? Perhaps that despair Ellen thought she saw was just the pain, which the nurse had said would be considerable, and that once she was back on her feet, she'd be back to her old ways. Her phone rang on the passenger seat beside her, and she saw that it was Patrick calling. He must be home with Jack by now and was wondering where she was. She was only a few minutes away, so she didn't bother pulling over to answer. There was no question that this would mark a turning point for him. Now that Jack had been hurt, he would definitely want to get the police involved. If Ellen tried telling him that she thought Saskia may have reached her own turning point, he probably wouldn't believe her. She remembered him crawling across the bed in that eerie dawn light, his face ugly with fear and fury. If she was wrong, if Saskia continued to stalk them, then Patrick's hatred for her was gradually going to destroy him. It was like acid corroding him from the inside. She felt that it had already given his personality sharp edges. Most of the time, those edges were hidden by the identity he liked to show the world, the easygoing, straightforward Aussie bloke. But over the last few months, as she'd got to know him, to truly know him, as they both moved beyond the infatuation stage, she'd seen the edges reveal themselves. The bitterness, the mistrustfulness, the anxiety. And he'd already suffered so much grief in his life before he even met Saskia. She wondered what sort of person Patrick would have been if Colleen had lived. They probably would have had more children after Jack. Patrick would have been a typical dad, involved with the school, leaving the domestic decisions to his wife. A simpler, sweeter person. A happier person. And the tiny baby who had waved at them yesterday would never have existed. Well, whatever. A foolish and pointless line of thought. She yawned again. She was not only exhausted but starving, that urgent, ravenous hunger she'd never experienced before pregnancy. When she got home, she wanted to climb into bed with a huge plate of toast and a cup of tea, and then she wanted to pull the covers up and fall straight into a deep, dreamless sleep. She would tell Patrick she was too tired to talk about anything, the past, the future, the present. Don't think about it, she ordered herself sharply. But it was useless, because she knew that on some level she hadn't thought about anything else since last night, even in spite of everything that had happened. It had added to the nightmarish quality of the past few hours. He doesn't love me as much as he loved Colleen. He has doubts. He looks at me and thinks of her and sees that it's not the same. He will never love another woman the way he loved Colleen. She examined her feelings slowly and tentatively, as if she was lifting a piece of clothing to examine a gunshot wound. Did it hurt? Yes, quite a lot. She thought about Saskia's matter-of-fact acceptance that Patrick would always love Colleen best, and she understood something with simple, startling clarity. I don't love Patrick as much as Saskia does. Saskia hadn't cared if she loved him more than he loved her, whereas Ellen did care. If she was handing over a slice of her heart, she wanted the exact same size given back in return. Actually, she really preferred a bigger piece, thank you very much. What she really wanted was to be adored. She was having a baby. She deserved to be adored. Well, that was just infantile, wasn't it? Women had babies all the time without the support of an adoring partner. She had a loving partner. That should be enough. She was lucky. Her own mother had given birth without a man. Ellen was lucky. She had more than her fair share of love. In fact, perhaps that was the problem. She'd been spoiled with far too much adoration. She would forget about what Patrick had said about Colleen. She would never think about it or tell a friend, and she would certainly never mention it to him. Yes, it might be difficult, but it was the right thing to do. There was a polite toot of a horn from the car behind her, and she realized that the traffic light she'd been waiting at had turned green while she was sitting there feeling virtuous. She lifted her hand in apology and put her foot on the accelerator. Lucky, she reminded herself. So you're going to need a lot of support over the next couple of months. Finished up my doctor. He seemed very young, with flushed, baby-smooth cheeks. I must be getting old. I remember when Mum was in the hospital, she couldn't get over the youth of her doctors. I get the giggles, she told me. They sound so serious, but they just look like kids playing dress-up, she whispered to me. The kids knew what they were talking about, though. She'll probably make it through Christmas, one of them told me, but not much longer. I wasn't there when she died. I had to go home because Jack was starting school. Funny that I thought it was home. My doctor confirmed what Ellen had already told me. Fractured pelvis, broken ankle. They were scheduling me for surgery the next day. I was going to be on bed rest for the next 6 weeks. I wonder how long Jack's arm would take to heal. I don't have any family, I told him. I don't know why I said that. Perhaps I thought he could prescribe me one. Well, you're going to need to rely on your friends, he said. I noticed you had a visitor earlier. She seemed like a close friend, very concerned about you. He was talking about Ellen. I said, I don't think she'll actually be visiting again. Oh, he said. Well, as I say, you're going to need support, so you might want to call in some favors. Don't worry, people love to help in a crisis. Makes them feel good, you know, useful. You'll be surprised at how your friends will step up. I'm sure I will be, I said. I couldn't tell him that there was no one to step up, that I didn't have that ordinary social framework, that there was just me, and there was no one I could possibly ask for help. This man had no idea that people like me existed, people who look and sound well-educated and normal on the outside, but are actually as lonely and crazy as a homeless bum. Then I remembered that the difference between me and a homeless person is that I have money. I'll pay someone to be supportive, I thought. There must be some sort of service for people like me. You'll get through this, said the doctor. I tried to smile politely, but my facial muscles rebelled as if it was an unfamiliar move, as if I'd never smiled before. The doctor pressed the morphine clicker into my hand and patted my shoulder. Give yourself some pain relief. Enjoy it while it lasts. We'll be weaning you off soon enough. I pressed the red button. Jack was sound asleep when Ellen got home. He was lying in his bed, curled up on his side, looking tiny and pale, the arm in the cast over the blanket. The doctor prescribed him some strong painkillers, said Patrick quietly as they stood together in his bedroom looking down at him. He pulled the quilt up and let his hand rest briefly on Jack's forehead. He'll probably sleep for hours. As they walked down the stairs together, Ellen felt Patrick's fury rise steadily like a boiling kettle. They went into the living room and he began pacing back and forth, talking non-stop. He hadn't yet asked where Ellen had been. He wanted to tell her about how he'd already phoned the police and they told him to come in to make a full report and begin the process of taking out a restraining order against Saskia. How Jack's injuries could have been so much worse, how he thought Jack was dead when he saw him lying at the bottom of the stairs. And did she think that too? And that he should have taken the restraining order out so much sooner, and he'd never forgive himself for that. Never. I've been trying to work out how she got in, he said finally. I don't know, said Ellen tiredly. While Patrick had been talking, she had lain down on her grandfather's leather couch and put her forearm over her eyes. Patrick had offered her a cup of tea when she first got home, but so far it hadn't materialized.
I moved the key after the last time.
What? Said Patrick. Ellen realized her mistake too late. She opened her eyes. Patrick had stopped pacing and was standing frozen in the middle of the room.
What last time?
She opened her mouth to speak and closed it again. She was desperately trying to find the right balance between honesty and enraging him further. She gave up.
She left biscuits on the doorstep when we went up to the mountains, she said. I think she might have cooked them in my kitchen.
What? She broke in before and you neglected to tell me?
Well, I might have been wrong.
Ellen sat up and folded her arms protectively across her stomach.
I just had a feeling.
Patrick was looking at her almost as if he wanted to hit her. An image came into her mind of the way he grabbed Saskia by the shoulders, as if he was about to throw her up against the wall.
I'm not Saskia, she said involuntarily. I know you're not, he said with an impatient, disgusted move of his hand. But why did you not mention this to me?
I didn't want to upset you, said Ellen. I know how much it upsets you.
You threw them out straight away, of course.
Of course, said Ellen. Honesty was often overrated. Because they probably had rat poison in them, or Christ, I don't know, anthrax.
She doesn't want to kill you, Patrick. She loves you.
How do you know what she wants? Said Patrick. You have no idea what she wants. God almighty, the woman watched us sleep last night.
I just talked to her at the hospital, said Ellen. I think it's finished. I really do.
She promised me.
Anyway, she's going to be stuck in bed for a long time.
Patrick sat down on the chair in front of Ellen. It was the chair where her grandmother always used to sit to watch TV. Patrick looked too big and rough for it. Ellen had to stop herself from saying, "Don't sit there."
You talked to her? Said Patrick slowly. Why would you do that?
I just felt if I talked to her, I might be able to make a difference.
Right, said Patrick.
He ran the palm of his hand roughly across his face, pulling at the stubbled skin.
So you two girls have a nice chat?
I really think she's hit rock bottom, began Ellen.
Oh dear, the poor thing, said Patrick.
Ellen went silent. He'd earned the right to be sarcastic. They locked eyes for a few seconds, and then Patrick looked away and shook his head. He took a deep breath.
You're meant to be on my side.
I am, said Ellen immediately.
It feels like you're on her side.
That's silly. If you had some ex-boyfriend stalking you the way Saskia stalks me, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd knock his head off.
You're saying I should have punched Saskia? Said Ellen unfairly, but needing all the points she could get.
Of course not, said Patrick tiredly. He sat back and closed his eyes. There was a pounding sensation at the very center of Ellen's forehead. Her wrist itched unbearably. Guilt. That's what she was feeling, because he was partly right. She'd tried harder to understand what it must be like to be Saskia than she'd tried to understand what it would be like to be Patrick. The mature thing would be to say nothing, to not try to defend herself, and to certainly stop aligning herself with Saskia. Instead, she said, Are you thinking it now?
Thinking what?
Patrick opened his eyes. Are you thinking about Colleen?
What are you talking about? Why would I be thinking about Colleen? What has she got to do with anything?
He looked completely, innocently baffled. So much for her virtuous decision in the car. Part of her longed to rewind and take it back, but the other part, her basic, instinctual self, wanted everything, every single thing, out in the open.
You said last night that sometimes you look at me and you think about Colleen, and you think that it's not the same, and that you'll never love anyone as much as you loved Colleen.
I said that? Said Patrick. He paused.
I never said that.
You were in a hypnotic state, admitted Ellen.
He didn't say I would never have said that.
So it was like I was sleep-talking, said Patrick slowly.
Sort of, said Ellen. You were somewhere between asleep and awake.
So when we do these hypnosis sessions,
Do you ask me stuff? Said Patrick. You ask me stuff about Colleen. Is that why you do it? So you can go ferreting about in my head?
Of course not, said Ellen.
The phone began to ring. She wondered if she should use it as an opportunity to escape from this conversation, which did not seem to be going well. She looked down and saw that she'd been scratching at her wrist so hard that there were little flecks of blood.
Let them leave a message, said Patrick.
They sat there looking at each other while the phone rang and rang.
The morphine made everything melt. The ceiling softened and swirled. The white blanket covering my body rippled like water. When I closed my eyes to get away from the melting room, I saw images from my life slapped in front of me like playing cards, one after the other in rapid succession. Patrick waiting for me outside the movie theater, deep in thought, looking so sad, and then his face changing, lighting up when he saw me arrive. My mother, when her hair was still blonde, driving me home from school, looking at the road ahead and laughing over something I'd said. The kids who moved in next door, looking up at me with their trusting, nonchalant eyes. Lance from work, standing in my office, eagerly handing over the Wire DVD series. I opened my eyes and remembered I had a job, and that I should probably let them know that I wouldn't be coming in for a while. I called on the phone next to my bed. Nina answered, and when I heard her familiar, cheery voice, I had a sensation of horror, as if I was in a dream and I'd walked into the office naked. The game was up. They were going to find out the truth. I heard myself say, Nina, it's me, Saskia. Oh, hey, Saskia. I didn't know you were out this morning. Look, I've been wanting to ask you about...
Nina, I said.
It felt like I was talking underwater. I gripped the phone hard. I must have waited too long to speak because she said,
Are you still there?
I hit rock bottom, I said.
I beg your pardon?
I don't know what to say to you, said Patrick. His eyes looked glassy. My head is too full of last night. I have no memory of saying that thing about Colleen.
I shouldn't have mentioned it, said Ellen. She was desperately disappointed with herself. Her mobile phone began to ring somewhere in the house.
Can we talk about it later? Asked Patrick. I want to go to the police station while Jack is asleep and make that report.
Of course, said Ellen. Actually, let's just forget I ever...
We're not going to forget it, said Patrick. We're going to talk about it later.
He smiled at her, and the unexpectedness of it made her want to cry. I promise. We're going to talk about everything at length later, and we're going to fix it.
Right. Now her office phone was ringing again. Sounds like someone needs to talk to you, said Patrick.
Yes, said Ellen, and then the air rushed from her lungs.
Oh, God, I forgot. I completely forgot.
What?
Ellen looked at the clock above Patrick's head and tried to will the hands to move backward. It was 2:30 p.m.
That journalist, I was meeting her at a cafe at 11 this morning.
She imagined the journalist sitting in the cafe, tapping her fingers and irritably checking and rechecking her watch. She was already ill-disposed toward Ellen. Now she would think that she'd deliberately not turned up. She would think that she had something to hide.
Reschedule, said Patrick. Tell her there was an accident. It's not your fault.
Yes, said Ellen, because of course that was logical, but she already knew that it was going to be a disaster. And when she listened to the messages on both her office phone and mobile, she knew she was right.
I'm waiting in the cafe you suggested, said Lisa, with a faint emphasis on the word you and the sounds of the cafe in the background adding to Ellen's guilt. I'll be filing the story this afternoon, so if I don't hear from you soon, I'll assume you have no comment, and you're not interested in responding to the issues raised by your former clients.
As Ellen hung up, the phone immediately rang again, and she snatched it up, desperate for the chance at redemption. It was her mother.
I've been trying to call you all morning, she said accusingly. I really need to talk to you.
I can't talk, said Ellen. I'll call you back.
The phone rang again. It was Julia, her voice low and throaty. Guess who just left my bed?
I can't talk right now, said Ellen again.
This was becoming like some sort of awful comedy. I'm sorry.
She hung up. Breathe, said Patrick, standing at her office door.
Shut up!
She called the journalist's mobile number. The phone went straight to voicemail. Ellen tried to keep the panic out of her voice as she left a message.
My stepson had an accident, she said. I've been at the hospital.
Her voice didn't sound authentic. It sounded forced and fraudulent. She felt like she was lying because she'd never called Jack her stepson before, and because she hadn't been at the hospital with him. She'd been at the hospital seeing Saskia. Patrick mimed deep breaths at her. Ellen waved him away. The guilt she was feeling was all out of proportion. She hadn't murdered anyone. In fact, she hadn't actually done anything except forgotten an appointment. As she completed her message, I'd still love the opportunity to talk to you. Love the opportunity? She sounded like a telemarketer. She heard the doorbell ring. Patrick went downstairs to open the door, and Ellen's heart sank as she recognized the client's voice. It was Mary-Kate turning up late as usual for her 2:30 p.m. appointment. Mary-Kate certainly deserved a paragraph in the article exposing Ellen. The journalist could calculate how much Mary-Kate had spent over the last few months without any progress. Then they could mention how much Ellen had spent on those boots she'd only worn once.
I'm a bad person, thought Ellen. A bad, bad person. He'll never love me the way he loved Colleen. He'll eventually leave me and I'll be a single mother like Mum. Without a job. And to top it all off, in 5 very short years, I'll be 40. 40! Mary-Kate! She called out, filled with decisiveness.
She walked briskly down the stairs as Patrick ushered Mary-Kate inside.
I'm very sorry, but I can't see you today. In fact, I can't see you again.
Mary-Kate looked startled. Ellen registered that there was something different about Mary-Kate today. Her face didn't look as doughy as usual. Also, she was carrying a bunch of flowers, and she was wearing a long, buttercup yellow scarf.
I'll just check on Jack before I go out.
Patrick raised his eyebrows questioningly at Ellen over the top of Mary-Kate's head, his tired eyes clearly trying to communicate something along the lines of, Are you sacking all your clients now? He gave a minute shrug and disappeared up the stairs.
Is everything okay? Asked Mary-Kate.
Not really, said Ellen. I think there's going to be an article in the paper tomorrow that's going to destroy my reputation.
Which paper?
Said Mary-Kate immediately, as if she was going to rush out and buy a copy. The Daily News, said Ellen. I'd really rather you didn't read it, to be honest. But look, my point is...
Well, let's see what we can do about it, said Mary-Kate.
Oh, and by the way, these are for you. She handed over the flowers.
Thank you.
Ellen stared at the flowers. They were yellow like Mary-Kate's scarf.
I really don't think there's anything you can do, although I appreciate...
Tell me everything.
Pardon?
To the extent that you can do so without breaching confidentiality, tell me everything that has happened.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
I'm a barrister, said Mary-Kate. I specialize in defamation law.
Chapter 24. But I have a little boy. Colleen Scott's first words upon being told that she had only a few months to live. I dreamed that Lance from the office was sitting next to my hospital bed, together with a pale, red-haired woman I didn't know.
No, Lance, I still haven't watched The Wire, I said for my own entertainment.
That's okay, he said. It wasn't a dream. Lance really was sitting next to my bed.
Are you in a lot of pain? Said the woman. My cousin broke her pelvis years ago. She said the pain was worse than childbirth.
I haven't experienced childbirth, I said. Who was this woman?
Me neither, she said. It's the universal pain benchmark, isn't it? It's like you can't talk about pain unless you've experienced childbirth, although apparently passing a kidney stone is worse.
We should be taking her mind off the subject of pain, said Lance.
I was trying to show empathy, said the woman. I always say the wrong thing at hospital visits.
She glanced at me and said,
I'm Kate, by the way. Lance's wife, if you can't place me. We met at last year's Christmas party.
Of course, I said, although I wasn't sure I could remember meeting her before. Didn't I usually find an excuse for not going to the Christmas party?
We just thought we'd stop by, said Lance.
We're on our way to the movies, said Kate.
There was silence. I couldn't think of anything to say. I didn't understand why they were visiting me. Then I said, What movie are you seeing?
at the same time as Lance said, I've got a card from everyone at the office. He handed me a white envelope with my name on it.
And chocolates.
Kate held up a box and waved a hand in front of it like a game show hostess.
And trashy magazines.
Oh, and grapes. Very unoriginal. I tried to open the card, but I couldn't seem to manage it. My hands were shaking too much.
Let me do that, said Lance gently.
Would you like a chocolate? Said Kate.
Maybe later, I said.
Do you mind if I have one?
Kate, said Lance.
Sorry, she said.
You can have one, I said. I looked at the card Lance had given me